Okay. Okay, so we are starting Perek Bet Halacha Bet. Okay, we're in the third piece on the second chapter in Hilchot Deot. Today's newspaper was a classic example of this question. Okay? Because part of the question is, how do you know when you've reached an extreme? Okay? Right? So, there were three stories, and by the way, I'm almost done with this. This will be in the usual spot. Friday's paper is waiting for you, for those who want to take it back to the dorm. There was a terrible story that made the front page of the paper today, okay? An IDF officer, and they haven't published his name because, you know, it's obviously the evidence hasn't been checked yet. But basically, he's being accused. I don't know if he's going to be accused of attempted rape. And apparently, if this is a true story, this fellow is on the security detail of the chief of staff of the Ramatkal. So he's supposed to be way up there in terms of what an officer should be. And the facts are so bad. He's apparently supposed to get married like this week or next week or something. And he was coming back, or maybe it was the day after his bachelor party, which is a discussion also worth having. And apparently his friends took him to a strip club where they celebrated his bachelor party. I'm going to put aside how ridiculous that is, that a person would celebrate his upcoming marriage. I'm not even going to go there, but it's a good example of what I'm about to talk about. And apparently he got very drunk. Again, this is just sort of the story in the paper. And he forced this woman, dragged her down to the Arkon River. Fortunately, some passerbys came by. They called the police. He saw people coming, ran away. They caught him basically with his. Can you do me a favor, Moshe Bokerto, just to hit the door? Caught him basically with his trousers off, hiding in the bushes near the Arkon River, which is, you know, reasonably incriminating, right? And you look at a story like that, and you imagine that if this person, in fact, you know, there was someone on the radio, because this is, thank God, in Israel, this is still this makes front page news. I mean, I don't think this would make front page news in New York. But in Israel, an Israeli army officer who's accused of rape is front page news. That just doesn't happen. That's just extremely rare. And the people who, you know, sort of were commenting, because they always find someone on the scene who wants to get on the news, saying this is so out of character for this individual that they can't imagine it's true, and they're sure the police can investigate, and they think maybe there was someone else. It doesn't make any sense. Now, let's say that that's true. Let's say it's all true. Let's say it's totally out of character. And let's say alongside with its being out of character, right, it remains true. What that means is that you have an individual that has arrived at such an extreme, right, that this will probably be the day that he remembers as the bottom of the pit. You know, we talked about this last week. Sometimes a person has to hit the bottom before he can start to climb his way up, right? How do you know that you've hit the bottom? How do you stop yourself from hitting the bottom? Do you have to hit the bottom in order to climb your way up? I mean, that's an extreme situation. How does a person arrive at such an extreme? Nobody's educated to such extremes, right? And there were two other stories which interested me because they were one on top of the other. One is that Demjanjuk, who I assume everybody knows who Ivan Demjanjuk is, Demjanjuk's trial opens tomorrow in Germany. Okay? That's an example of a generation that reached an extreme, right? How can a human being be brought up on Western values and end up being indicted for 29,000 counts of murder? And that's just what they know of. And then right underneath that, it's almost like Hashem sometimes Hashem always arranges the newspaper. The chief rabbi of England, okay, Rabbi Sachs, was inducted into the House of Lords. I have no idea what that really means, and to be honest, it's not really up there on my priority list. But the picture caught my eye. There's a picture of Rabbi Sachs. This is a Rav, and a tremendous Talmud Chacham, right? And he's wearing the red robe, okay, of the English House of Lords, and he gave a speech to the House of Lords. Now, if you know the history of England, right, the fact that for hundreds of years the Jewish people were expelled from England, the fact that the chief rabbi of England is now an official member of the House of Lords, and in his speech, one of the lines, you know, he speaks about how proud we are to be British and that and that there are certain values. And he told the house that his parents loved Britain because of its virtues of tolerance, its decency, and its undemonstrative yet indomitable sense of fairness and justice. Now, I'm not going to get into sort of the pros and cons of England and whether English Jewry would be better off in Israel. I imagine you know my opinion on the matter. But this individual, at least in my mind, is clearly an example of a fellow who has achieved a certain level of balance, of tolerance, of moderation. How do you find that? How do you see the extreme on the one hand, the balance on the other, right? And what do you do with that? So here's where we get to the Rambam. Remember that the Rambam said that allegorically one can compare it to an illness, that a person thinks that what's bitter is sweet and what's sweet is bitter, right? You look at your life and the things that are really meaningful, right? You know, I was standing in line at the post office one Friday, and I was standing next to somebody, and we started talking, and we were talking about how we miss Sundays, you know? Because I got cured of Sundays. Then I went back on Shlichut for 3 years to America. And so, you know, you taste what a Sunday can be. And I think that's something that you can value if it's done properly. And that was the day that I really had for family time, whatever. So in Israel, you don't have Sundays, but you have Fridays, right?
Friday's
so,
not a day.
Pardon?
Friday's barely a day.
Friday's barely a day. Friday's nothing. What Friday gives you is it gives you Shabbos.
No, it's all just preparing.
Right. It's all running around. You don't. Nobody takes the day off, chills. You certainly don't have, right? You have a little Thursday night like Saturday night in America, but you definitely don't have Friday like Sunday. I agree with you. What Friday does give you is it gives you a different entry into Shabbat. Like in my ideal world, you have Friday and Sunday. I'm working on that. The 4-day week. I could live with that, right? But we were talking about this. And he said to me, and I was standing there with my mouth was open. He looks at me and goes, "Oh, man, I don't miss Sundays." I said, "Really?" He said, "Oh, I hated Sundays." I said, "Really? You hated Sundays?" He goes, "Yeah, Sunday was family day." I'm thinking, okay, I'm missing something here. So I'm just listening. He goes, "Every Sunday, my wife got it into her head, we had to go visit family. So we would get all the kids in the car, and we'd have to go to, like, the family, this cousin, that cousin. And we'd go, and then we'd have to think of what to do. Where do we go? Where do we take the kids to eat? And where do we go? And like, you know, sometimes we'd go to, like, Jungle Habitat or Monkey This or Amusement Park That or go bowling." He goes, And then you'd come home and they'd all be wired and you'd have to catch up on whatever homework wasn't done until finally the kids would get to sleep at like 10 o'clock at night and then finally I'd be able to escape and watch the football game, okay? So I didn't say this to him because obviously you don't want to have, you know, whatever. But I walked away thinking, wow, that was just like, someone just stuck that in my face. That in my, this again, I'm not judging the person, but in my, at least my perspective, that's not just off. That's like radically off. Like, to have a day where you're with your kids in the car and you're visiting family, right? And to have that be what you dread is just off. And that's the best example I can think of somebody who thinks that what's sweet is bitter. Go sit with someone who, God forbid, lost a loved one. Go sit with my cousins whose son was killed in the Second Lebanon War and ask them how much they wish that they could have just one Sunday in the car with all the kids, right? Like when I take time, you know, I'll get home. My wife went to the States last night, so I'll get home tonight at a normal hour and at whatever time that is, and we'll sit, and the cell phone will go on the desk, and the laptop will be closed. And from like, I don't know, whatever it is, 7 till like 10 o'clock at night, that's my time with my kids. And we have chavrutot, and we learn, and we do dinner. And even if it means I end up staying up till 1, 2 in the morning because of all the other stuff I have to do, that's not like a chore. I'm actually looking forward to that. And you realize how easy it is for what's really sweet in life to become bitter, right? And you meet people in their relationships, like where their spouse goes away, and they're like, "Oh, I'm so excited because now I get some time on my own." Like, that's an interesting question. How do you define what's sweet and what's bitter, right? So you can reach an extreme, right? Like time with your children, that should be a good thing. Time with each other. This year, by the way, is a perfect example. Like, there are definitely aspects of a year in Israel that are challenging, you know? To sit and learn all day and to grow. Real growth comes with work. It's hard work, definitely. Especially some of you came from like a lot less work in senior year. So to put the work in, but can you imagine you have this year, I promise you, 20 years from now, you will look back, no matter what you accomplished this year, no matter what you did, and you will look back at this time, you'll look back at this day, and you'll recognize that this day was a gift. But can you recognize that this day is a gift today? Can you recognize what a gift it is? You have no papers. You have no homework. You have no stress. You shouldn't have stress. If you have stress, come talk to me. You know, we can talk about why you shouldn't have stress, right? You just have this day to grow, to do with whatever you, you know, right? But do you appreciate it when you have it? That's the challenge. So listen to what the Rambam says. The Ketzad hi refuatam. It's interesting that the Rambam talks about this as a cure, as healing, right? Okay? How do you heal a person? A person who's that off, it's a sickness. There's something off with a person who thinks that spending time with your children is a chore, right? And there's something off with a person, and I don't mean this, God forbid, as a judgment, because a judgment would mean that you're doing something wrong. This isn't necessarily, you know, it's like judging a person who has swine flu. You can't judge a person. He gets sick because someone infected him, and that's just fine, you know? You don't want to lie next to him when he's upchucking or whatever, but, you know, that's just where we're at. So if a person is in this headspace, it's because of where he is, because of his environment, because of culture, because of the things he's been exposed to, whatever it might be.
But in all fairness, not the guy who, the family should want to spend time with aren't some relatives, like some distant relatives. It's the immediate family. So why can't he just... His wife should just let him watch a football game with his kids.
Well, it would be reasonable to me, and again, you're right, I'm making a judgment call that can't possibly be 100% accurate. If a guy says every once in a while we would go and we would have to visit the cousin that I can't stand, so then there are lots of pieces. First of all, to have anyone in this world that you can't stand is something to work on.
But they have to do it every week.
Well, one second. Second of all, there's something flawed in the relationship. If you're struggling with something and yet you have to do it every week, you shouldn't have that. If there's something that so bothers me, I can't imagine my wife would make me do it every week. There's something off there, right? And third of all, the fact that at the end of a day with your children and you have this whole day and they don't have to go to school. You know, when I was in Florida, so I read this amazing article and it really impacted me. At the beginning, I understand, it's the beginning, like you have Sunday, and, you know, Dorit would say, you know, we should do something. We're here in Florida. We come from Israel. We know that we're not going to have these opportunities later. We're not staying in Florida. So let's find things to do. So we found that we would go, like, every, you know, at the beginning, it was like every week we would go, like, canoeing, or we would go to, like, the Everglades, or we would go on Teulim, whatever it might be. And after about 4 or 5 weeks of this, I said, okay, this is, like, too much. Like, we don't need to do this every week, right? And she agreed. So then we started doing it every once in a while, right? But then you have this pressure, right? Because the kids come in and they want to know what to do. And they finish their homework because, you know, my kids would do their homework either Friday afternoon or Saturday night or whatever. Because you finish homework first. And so they've got Sunday to do whatever, right? And so they would come in and say they're bored. And I feel bad. And then I realized, you know what? Bored is not bad. Bored's a bracha. Bored's a good thing. When I was a kid, I was bored. So that forced me to use my imagination. So what do people do today when they're bored? They open up their iPod or they turn on a movie or they watch video, right? And what they basically do is they don't have to employ their imagination. Like somebody asked me here in this yeshiva not long ago, why is it so important to read? Why do you think reading is valuable? Which I thought was a very honest question, because you can get most of the information now without reading. You can watch a movie. Because reading challenges your imagination. Using your imagination, I know I sound like a parent here, right? But using your imagination, right, actually develops your thought processes and your relationship building and all sorts of other skills. It's just healthy, right? So I decided to do an experiment on one particular Sunday, you know, a few months into being in Shechut, one of my kids said, Abba, I'm bored. And I said, you know, that is great. I am so happy you're bored. Now you're going to have to think of what to do. And you can't use the TV to do it. This took about a half an hour. And eventually my kids realized that that was my answer. And they found what to do. They played ball. They played card games. They made up hide-and-seek games. They did all sorts of things that were much, much more valuable than almost anything that I could have come up with to take them on. Being bored is good. It's a gift. It's a challenge. What do you do with it? How do you fill that time? So I'm not saying that it's off that a person is sometimes doing something they're not thrilled about. But you could actually get to a different stage. If you're in a car and you're on your way to visit a relative, Hashem has decided that you're in the car and you're going to visit the relative. You can either be miserable about it, or you can decide, this is an opportunity. I'm going to revel in this opportunity. And by the way, you can revel in anything. You can actually revel in the fact that your daughter has a brain tumor and you need to struggle with what's going on. You can revel. You can decide that for whatever reason you don't get it yet, but if this is what Hashem gives you, then this is what you're going to do with it. Everything in life is a gift. Everything in life is an opportunity. Every challenging experience is an opportunity. The only question is, do you appreciate that? What do you do with that? So that's a perception. But now the Rambam is going to get into, okay, what do you do when you're off? Like, this is just off. I mean, this is an Israeli officer with a promising career. He's getting married, and one day he's on top of the world, and the next thing you know, he's sitting in a prison cell, possibly going to be indicted for rape. That's just an extreme. Agreed? That's an extreme. And when you realize that you've arrived at an extreme, so two questions you have to ask yourself. One is, okay, so how did I get here? I mean, if you think about it hard enough, it's not difficult to come up with someone that you've met or someone that you know or someone you've experienced in life that you realize reached an extreme. So first question is how you get there. And second question is what you do about it. But can you figure out that you're headed towards an extreme when it's not an extreme? Like, imagine somebody walks in and says, listen, Benny, sorry to interrupt. I just got to ask you a question. Do you have any tissues? Now, agree with me, that'd be a little off. Like, we're in the middle of a shiur or somebody interrupts, whatever. But suppose I said to him, could you be quiet? So that'd be a little bit of an extreme. Now, that's not a radical extreme. It wouldn't cause all of you. Like, if I got up and pulled out a pistol and shot him, you know, you'd all be calling your parents. And you'd probably, maybe I'm in the wrong yeshiva, right? I don't think you'd leave the yeshiva because I snapped at a person. But you'd walk away thinking, that's a little off. Now, suppose I realized that that was off. Well, then that would be a good thing. That would mean maybe that I have stress in my life, that something's going on, that I need to work on that. Right? Can you get there before you get there? This is really valuable. So the Rambam says, what if you got there? Like, if you look at the end of Perek Aleph, the Rambam talks about this at the end of Perek Aleph. He says, in Perek, V'ketzad yergil adam atzmo b'de'ot elu ad sheikavubo. How does a person find this middle ground? And now we see that we're plowing the same field. So one way of understanding this is that the end of the first chapter, the end of Perek Aleph, is talking about the case where a person isn't at an extreme. He's just recognizing where the middle is, and he knows he's not there. But this is a person who reaches an extreme. Okay? So how do you fix this? Mishahu baal chema. Now what does baal chema mean? Anybody want to take a guess? Where does the word chema come from? What word does it remind you of? Cham. A hot person. Anger. Why is anger automatically, like, we didn't plan this? Why is heat automatically associated with anger? Why do you think? Why do you think heat is automatically associated with anger? And cool is automatically associated with calm, moderation. Why? Or the other extreme. Why do you think heat is associated with anger?
Heat spreads fast.
Heat spreads fast. Well, a lot of things spread fast, but okay. That's true. Anger spreads much more quickly than calm. In fact, if you're angry and I'm calm, sometimes my calm gets you angrier. Right? Heat up, okay. What else, yeah?
It's more just like generally like out of control.
Okay. There's a Mishnah in Baba Kama. Okay, Baba Kama talks about, I think the guy studied that last year in the Gemara. There's a Mishnah that talks about there are Arba Avot Nezikin. There are four major categories of damages, and one of them is Hever, is Eish, is fire. And what makes fire unique is that its nature is to go and destroy. Fire, by nature, is a destructive force. Now, you can channel fire. You can use fire to give light. You start Shabbat with fire. In fact, fire represents... Do you ever wonder why you start Shabbat with fire and you end Shabbat with fire? Because, right, it's interesting. There was a study in... I think it was in Stanford University. They were trying to find common themes in different cultures. They actually began because they were exploring the flood. There were a couple of anthropologists who noticed that there were flood stories common to a number of different cultures. So they examined, they did this whole doctoral, you can probably find it online. They examined 120 different cultures. I mean, you know, Indians in South America and in Africa and in Asia, all over the world, including, by the way, the Jews. And they found that there were certain, I think there were seven epic stories that were common to almost all of these cultures. One of them was a flood. One of them was the creation of fire. That early on in the history of the creation of man, that the first or one of the first creations or gifts or discoveries of man was fire. And there's a medrash that says that Hashem blessed Adam and gave Adam the gift of fire and whatever. Right? So fire represents man's ability to be a partner with Hashem in channeling the world. Right? So fire has enormous potential, but it has potential for great destruction. Okay? Now it's interesting that the Rambam chooses as his first example of an extreme, anger. And you're going to see that anger is one of two qualities, of all the different qualities that the Rambam lists, that are unique. Right? If you remember the beginning of Hilchot Deah, so the Rambam lists all these different libriot, all these different character traits. Right? He says, Yesh adam shu bal chema ko'etz tamid. There is a person who is a hot type of personality who's always angry, right? So chema means anger. And then he says that there are people who are calm. They never get angry. And there are people who are arrogant, and there are people who are who are too sort of humble. And there are people who have tremendous appetites, and there are people who are pure, and there are people who are stingy, and people who are tight-fisted, and he gives a whole list of different, right? But anger is always the first. So it's an interesting question why anger is the first. We're going to get to that, right? So he says, let's say a person is just an angry person. Omrim lo lan higatzmo she'im hukav v'kula lo yargish klal. Okay, this is the first place that we really see the Rambam demonstrating that if you're in an extreme, you have to go to the other extreme. Okay? If you have an issue and you discover that that's an issue, and usually you discover that's an issue because it's reached an extreme, right? Then you have to go to the opposite extreme. Now, there are two things that are important about this. One thing that's important about this is the recognition that the opposite extreme is not the goal. The opposite extreme is the vehicle to get you to the goal. Give me an example of an extreme that you think you or a person or someone, as an example, that someone could struggle with. Give me an extreme. Give me an example of an extreme. Anything. Any behavioral extreme. Give me an example.
Extreme laziness.
Pardon?
Laziness.
Extreme laziness. Okay, let's say a person has extreme laziness. So how would you define an extreme laziness? That a boy comes here, let's say, and he hasn't gotten out of bed in 2 weeks. But he's not sick. He just can't get out of bed. He just loves being in bed. Right? He's sitting at the table here, and someone says, could you pass me the pencil? And he looks and goes, do you mind getting up and getting it? Like that's off. So what would the Rambam suggest? What would a person have to do, right, to combat the extreme of laziness? He would have to be so, what would the word be? But not just active. Enthusiastically active. Like, he would have to walk into the basement. He would never, if he wanted to, he wouldn't be able to beat that extreme by coming here every day and being on time at 9:15, right? Or by being on time for minyan at 8. He would have to decide that he's going to get here every day at 6:30, right? At 5:30. If he really wants to beat laziness, he would start getting here every day at 6:30, be the first one in and the first one out. He would run in to clean up the basement every morning. He would tell the Torah Nim, you know what, I just need to beat my laziness. I'm going to take Torah Nim down for the yeshiva. Right? He would start washing floors. Like, that's an extreme. Like, the definition of an extreme is that you look at a person and after a little while you say, you know, you're going too fast. Like, you need to chill. Like, you don't have to be there every morning at 5:45. That's the definition of an extreme. If that person succeeded in practicing that extreme for X amount of time, then you'd be able to get back to the middle. Now, that raises a lot of questions, like, how much is that X? How long do you do that for? Right? It's an interesting question. Why do you need to go to an extreme? Why not just practice moderation? Decide that you're going to be here every day on time. Pardon?
I think you get too comfortable with where you are.
But that's okay, that's where you want to be. You want to be on time every day.
Practice an extreme, you see how far you can really get and how opposite you could be. If you're really angry and all of a sudden you're extremely nice to everyone, you see what potential you had to be nice to everybody else, even though it might be a little bit maybe too extreme. But
okay. Okay, could be. I think it goes a little deeper. I think, yeah, no? I think that the second point here is something that intellectually doesn't always sit, but when you look at life, always works. And that is that action impacts the soul. Okay? You know, it's like imagine that you're studying tefillah. Like imagine you came here with a goal that you want to see if you could fall in love with. You fill in the blank. Davening, mitzvot, Shabbat, kashrut, God, whatever it is. Okay? Should know that you will never get anywhere by study alone. You could come here and get the best class in the world. You could sit with Rabbi Aaron from here until tomorrow. You could come to every class and then sit again and review it on digital recording and just until you know it by heart. It will not really impact you in a deep way. It's just the content of the suitcase. It's like getting all the ingredients to make dinner. Until you get in the kitchen and start cooking, you don't have dinner. You just have a bag of flour and a bag of sugar and some vegetables, right? What really changes a person, the way in which you begin to impact yourself, is by what you do. Judaism believes that action impacts the neshama. Now, that's very dangerous, because if you're just doing action, and there's no soul that goes along with the action, that can also catch up with you, right? But in fact, there's a Yerushalmi that says, allegorically, that Hashem says, let them leave me and just keep my mitzvah. If a person celebrated Shabbat and had no relationship with God, they'd be better off than intellectually contemplating God without Shabbat. And that's true for all of life's different spheres. If you want to be a better human being, I remember I told you that story, I think I told you that story, about Rabbi Cardoza, where he was sitting at that ecumenical interfaith conference with those Vietnam vets. Remember that story? Did I tell you that story? I'm sure I told you that story. Rabbi Cardoza is an amazing person. He actually was the assistant dean at Israelite years ago, and then he got sick, whatever. But a very, very fine human being. He has a PhD in philosophy from Oxford. And he has a whole center here in Yerushalayim. And he taught many, many years in Or Sameach. And he's very into, like, interfaith conferences. Like, the Christians and Muslims and Jews can all get together, right? So he's sitting in a hotel lobby at one of these interfaith conferences, and these three fellows come over to him, okay? And they ask him, are you a rabbi? He says, yeah. So they said, well, could we ask you a question? He says, sure. He says, so their spokesperson, I guess, of the three of them, starts asking these questions. He says, you know, we have this problem. And we've asked our ministers, priests, reverend, whatever, and we can't seem to get a good answer. We don't know what to do, right? Says, we all did a tour of duty in Vietnam. And we spent a year in Vietnam. And when we got to Vietnam, so, you know, we were horrified by the things we saw and the things we had to do. And the fellow speaking said, I remember the first time I had to go into a village and we just had to shoot because we didn't know who the enemy was and we killed, you know, we were killing civilians and it was just, you know, it destroyed me. He said, but by the end of the year, it was so easy to do those things. He says, we've completely lost our moral compass. We feel like we have no moral compass anymore. He says, I could go out of this hotel, walk out into the street, pull out a handgun, shoot the first person I saw, come back in and have a cup of coffee with you, and it wouldn't even bother me. He says, it bothers me that it doesn't bother me. Like, how did that happen? We grew up with good Christian values. He says, by the end of our tour in Vietnam, we would go into a hooch, and we would take bets as to who could shoot more people and how many times. Okay? So how do we get back our moral compass? So Ricardoza said, it's very simple. So they kind of arch their eyebrows. Well, it's a simple way. He says, just practice acts of loving kindness. He says, you don't feel like a good person, but act like a good person. Fake it. Go work in an orphanage, volunteer in a hospital, help the old. If you fake being good, you'll become good. That happens to be true. If you have a trait that you want to inculcate in yourself, fake it. Now, there's one exception to this rule, but fake it. Practice being what it is that you want to be, and you will become that person. Okay? If you want to be a person who is thoughtful, practice being thoughtful. Pretend to be thoughtful, and by pretending to be thoughtful, you'll become thoughtful.
But sometimes that's a bad idea. Why? Because you think you're too calm, so you should practice being angry.
Well, what is too? First of all, I'm not so sure that the opposite of calm is anger. The opposite of calm is inspired, is emotional. Anger we're going to get to in a minute, right? Tomorrow, right? But let's say that's right. Let's say you're sitting in a Holocaust survivor comes to talk, and he starts talking about like how he lost his wife and he lost his children, whatever, and he starts crying, and it's a really powerful experience. Let's say everyone in the room is moved, and you're sitting there and you're like, oh, when is this over? And then afterwards you realize like that really bothers you that you're not even moved by this. And you start to notice this in yourself. Like people come, you know, a poor beggar girl, you know, you pass by in the street, and she's begging and she's crying and she's 6 years old. It can't be an act, let's say. And you just walk by and say, ugh, stupid girl, right? It bothers you, right?
So you do...
Fake being inspired, being emotional, fake singing, fake, you know. If you fake something and you fake action, right? Now, it's a dangerous thing because you have to know that you're faking it. You know, I'll give you an example. I had this experience once with davening, which I'm sure I told you about, but whatever. When I was in 12th grade, I realized that I was going through all these motions, and I was davening, and I wasn't getting much out of it. And it really bothered me that I wasn't getting much out of it, right? Like, I would just, you know, go and daven and do this Shemoneh Esrei thing, and it was just like, okay, it was like rolling over me. But it bothered me, it was rolling over me. So I decided I wanted to try to see if I could have more kavanah, right? So I figured the smartest thing I could do, the first thing I could do was stop talking during davening. Like, that would be a good step in the right direction, right? So I figured I'm going to try to stop talking during davening and think about what I'm saying or whatever. Like, that was my own personal journey or whatever. So the first day I said, okay, I'm going to do this. And I had like a bunch of, you know, like we were buddies and we all sat together, you know, in davening in school, in high school. And the first day I decided I'm not going to talk during Chazaras HaShatz, like when the Chazan repeats or whatever, right? And I was a big Knicks fan. And this lasted exactly one mincha. Okay, like I'm trying this and one of my buddies comes over, right? And he says, hey, did you catch the game last night? Did you see Walt's move? Like Walt Fridge was unbelievable. I go, because I'm not talking now, right? Right? So he looks at me and goes, what's the matter with you? Right? So I said, right? Because I don't want to talk. I want to try not to talk, right? Right? So he looks at one of my buddies and goes, hey, Danny, check it out. Danny's a rabbi. Woo, super Jew. Hey, don't talk to Benny. Right? So that lasted a day. I realized that wasn't going to work. They ribbed me about that all afternoon. So I was thinking about this. So then I came up with this plan. Okay? Because I really wanted to try to see if I could get into davening. Right? So, but I didn't want to offend. Like, it was rude. I didn't want to be rude. So the next morning at davening, what I did was, when I finished my esrei, I kept my eyes closed. I just did this. I just kept my eyes closed. Now, you can't go over to somebody and talk to him when his eyes are closed, because you feel like an idiot, right? So I was finished with my esrei, and the chazan would do chazar shatz, and I would just stand there like this with my eyes closed, right? I was basically faking it. I wasn't having any more kavana than I did the day before, but I closed my eyes. I didn't want to talk. Well, so people stopped talking to me, right? And I kind of got in the habit of having my eyes closed. And gradually, I started to realize that I was actually getting more inspired and getting more involved in davening, because what I was doing was affecting what I was feeling. Now, it's important, because if you start thinking that because you close your eyes, you're there, well, that's very dangerous. Like, if you give tzedakah, even though it's annoying you, you should know that that's not where you want to be. You want to be at a point where you realize what a gift it is to tzedakah. But you can, now, there is one exception to this, by the way. Do you know what the exception is? What can you not fake? What can you not fake? You can't fake. Unfortunately. You can't fake being a Talmud Chacham. You're either learning Torah or you're not learning Torah. You can't fake learning Torah. And there's, the Rambam makes this pretty clear in Hilchos Talmud Torah. But everything else, absolutely. Right? You want to be a patient person, you can fake being patient. Somebody comes to talk to you, you're in a rush, you're totally impatient, but you want to be a patient person, pretend to be patient. Be patient to the extreme. Try to do it not at someone's expense. And you will become a more patient person. If you feel that you have an anger issue, practice being sickeningly nice, and you will find, eventually, that you'll be less angry. Just the nature of the beast. And that's what the Rambam is saying here. Right? Omrim lo la'anigatz moshim ukavikula lo yagish klal. Like, if a person's not an angry person, and you do something to him, he doesn't get easily offended. So find opportunities, and use them to not be offended. Right? He says you got to do this for a long time. This doesn't happen in a day. Now, the Rambam, personally, the Rambam is a master of definitions, of creating boundaries and paradigms. So whenever the Rambam uses a term that is not really definable, I think maybe what the Rambam is saying is, this really depends on you. You know what I mean? Like, you got to know yourself. You will know when you've reached a point where you can see the difference. And maybe even Hashem will give you opportunities to realize that you've reached a point where there's a difference, right? Ad sheyit aker hachema milibo, until you've uprooted the anger from your heart. V'imaya gavei lev, and if a person was arrogant, there are very few quality traits that are more abhorrent than arrogance. Like, you can't be with a person who's just so full of themselves, and it takes an extreme, you know, for a person to get to a point where he realizes he has to work on his arrogance. But if a person is arrogant, he has to practice just base humility, self-deprecation. And he should, like, dress nebbish and be nebbish and act nebbish. Not because that's the goal. That's not a healthy thing. But by allowing yourself to be humiliated, you'll get the arrogance out of your heart. Right? And achi akor gova lev mimenu, until you uproot the arrogance from yourself, v'yachzor l'derech ha'emtzait. And then you have to get back to the middle ground. Shehu derech atovat, because that's the good way to be. And when you get back to that middle ground, and here we'll stop, when you get back to that middle ground, then you got to follow that. You got to stick with that. Because it's so easy to get back to an extreme.
So what is the question? Everyone may not be as familiar, like the Nevadic movement, for example, who took this to an extreme, but I never got the sense that there was ever a middle ground. It's that's the way they conducted themselves almost. As a goal.
Well, that actually we're going to get to in the next halacha, which is Gimel. Because in halacha Gimel, the Rambam talks about those character traits that a person should always try and explain. There are two character traits, right? And we'll have to talk about why that is. There are two character traits that you actually don't want to find the middle path. One of them is anger, and one of them is arrogance. Now, that's an interesting question. Why are those two character traits different? And that explains why the Rambam always starts with those two. Anger isn't something that you allow yourself to be in the middle. Like, you sometimes get angry, but you don't get too angry. You should strive never to be angry. And arrogance isn't something like you have a little bit of arrogance. Arrogance is something like you should strive never to be arrogant. To the point where if you know you're not arrogant and someone thinks you're arrogant, you need to work on that. So that's Nevadic, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, well, that's because, and that's exactly what we were just talking about. Being passive, first of all, there are different aspects to being passive. There is that aspect of being passive. Like, I'll give you an example. Let's say that I had a Rebbe, okay? And I've given up trying to remember which stories I told you. So the deal is, if I'm in the middle of a story, besides the Daniel Schechter smile, right? So just tell me, yeah, we heard this one. Yeah, I don't mind, right? But I was in I had a Rebbe, and my mother had arranged for me to get a ride up to high school with this Rebbe. Only years later did I understand that this was a deal they must have made that had less to do with the fact that I needed the ride and more to do with the fact that she wanted me to be in the presence of this Rebbe for 30 minutes every morning on the way to school, I think. But okay. So like, whatever morning it was, I got a ride up. So one morning, we were on our way to school, and I actually had a test in this Rebbe's class that day, and we're driving past 178th Street. I lived on the west side of Manhattan. We were heading up to Riverdale, and a car came barreling off the ramp onto the freeway and slammed into the front of his car. Okay, you gotta imagine, we're going like 50, 60 miles an hour, and this car comes flying and send us slewing into this, all right? So this is like an intense experience, whatever. And he manages to get control of the car. And now there's like some big noise because he's obviously getting smashed. And fortunately, this guy realized he messed up. So he pulls over to the side. He also had his car damaged. We pulled over to the side, right? And he was in the middle of telling me a story, like this Rebbe, whatever, right? And he says, okay, just a second, right? And he gets out of the car. And they go do their switch papers, insurance, whatever it is, right? And I'm praying. One of the most powerful prayers I've ever prayed. Oh, God, please don't let the car start. Because you couldn't pick a better way to miss a test. Like, you're with the Rebbe who's giving the test, right? You don't even need an excuse. You've got your excuse, right? So I'm like, please. Like, and the test was like a 10. I'm like, let's get stuck here. This would be awesome. We'll all miss the test, right? No such luck. He gets back in, right? He says, sorry about that, whatever. And he starts the car, right? And everything's fine. Except now we've got, like, a little thumping. And we go on driving. He waits like 30 seconds, I guess, to make sure the car's driving. Then he just continues his story, the middle of the story. I'm like looking at him, whatever. And he finishes the story and he thinks it's funny. So he laughs, whatever. And I'm like sitting there. And then he's driving in the morning. He starts telling me another story. And finally, I can't hold it. I said, Rebbe, I understand. Like, that guy just creamed your car. Like, he just like totally ignored that. He was just telling the story. Aren't you like upset? Like, he creamed your car. So he looks at me. I don't remember any Gemara this Rebbe taught me. I don't remember much of the stories he told me. But this lesson I remember. He said, listen. He said, it's true that guy creamed the front of my car. He said, the front of my car is going to be creamed, and I'll have to go to the mechanic and do whatever it is. Now, I could be upset that the front of my car is creamed, or I could be happy that the front of my car is creamed. The front of my car is still going to be creamed, so I might as well be happy. And that's really true when you stop to think about it. So there's a type of passive energy that's just healthy.
Right, but not extremely passive.
Well, no, so it depends when. In other words, if a terrorist walks into the room and he's got an axe, right? And he screams, Allahu Akbar. And we're just passive and say, good morning. Like, that's off. But the opposite of that is not to be, what was your description of the opposite, right? Is not to be angry and bothered. The opposite of that is action. So if, in fact, you're passive to the extreme where you don't take action, you know, like some guy spills something and I spill my coffee all over Moshe and it's dripping in his pants and you're sitting there and it just doesn't bother you, right? And you know, somebody comes over to you and slaps you and you just sit there, right? So, you know, it could be that you need to do something. The extreme that is the opposite of that will not be anger. It'll be action. And you can practice it.
I don't think it's anger. I'm not saying the opposite is anger. I'm saying the opposite is not necessarily being upset, but being bothered that something has happened.
Well, no, because being passive is not an extreme. Being passive may well be the middle ground. And that's why you don't need to be bothered. You don't ever need to be bothered. It's human that we get bothered. But when you get bothered, right, you get stuck in something that you don't really want to be stuck in. Like, nobody wants to be in a state of being bothered.
There's definitely times in the middle ground when going to an extreme event. Like, if you think you're too generous, then not doing anything for anyone,
I'll give you an example. The halacha says that you're supposed to give between 10 and 20% of your parnasa to tzedakah. 10% is what you're supposed to give. 20% is the high level. You're not supposed to give 50% of what you make, because if you give 50% of everything you make, then theoretically you'll have less to give tzedakah next year, etc., right? Okay, let's say that's true. And let's say that you have a $300,000 house, and you earn, I don't know, $100,000 a year, right? And your wife sits you down in, let's say, March, and says, look, the accountant called me up because last year you gave away $900,000 to tzedakah, and that's why we're in debt, and that's why I can't shop in the supermarket, right? That's an extreme. And if that extreme has your wife sitting and saying to you, chas v'shalom, listen, if you can't stop giving away our money, I'm going to have to leave you because I can't live like this, and our children have no clothes, that's an extreme. So yes, the answer would be, you know what, for the next 9 months, you don't give tzedakah. In fact, you're not chayav to give tzedakah because you're a poor person now. You need to find out a way to get tzedakah. But that doesn't mean that's the goal. The goal is that you can get back to getting out of debt and earning enough funds that you can give $10,000 a year to tzedakah. Because that $10,000 is not yours anyway. It's just Hashem gives it to you to give to tzedakah. But that's exactly right. Sometimes, and you know, part of the question will be, and I'll leave you with this thought, how do you know you've arrived at an extreme? There are two ways to know you've arrived at an extreme. One is externally and one is internally. Externally is people have to tell you that you've arrived at an extreme. The goal is to arrive at that knowledge internally. So we'll talk tomorrow about how one does that and what the Rambam's recipe is for figuring that out, because that's the rest of this halacha. Food for thought, Boker Tov. Hope we have an awesome week. Thank you for staying awake. Okay. Right. Yeah, if everybody can help, I gather this is a Sunday morning challenge, just with Rav Sam's shiur room, to get it into order, that would be good.